Welcome to St. Louis on the Air. I'm Don Marsh. The slings and arrows of the Trump administration have been directed at journalists covering Washington and the White House. The press has been described as the opposition party, enemies of the people, and purveyors of fake news. Mizzou grad Major Garrett is chief White House correspondent for CBS and stands right in the middle of that verbal assault along with his Washington colleagues. He covered Donald Trump during the 2016 presidential campaign, and we are happy to have Major Garrett with us by phone. Major, thanks for spending some time.
Delighted to be with you. Very much so.
And you're in Nashville right now. Well, with the president?
Not with the president. He's heading first to Michigan for an event dealing with the auto industry and some alterations in the existing federal law on clean air requirements for the fleets. Vehicle fleet in America. Then he comes here to Nashville to lay a wreath at the grave of Andrew Jackson, a populist president that this current 45th president likes at times to try to emulate and bask in the historical glow of. And then he's got a rally here in Nashville in the evening.
And I suppose he'll be touting health care at the rally.
Well, I've tried to. We'll see what the reception is.
You know, how frustrating, Major, is your job these days? And can you kind of give me a sense of what the collective mood of your colleagues might be in covering this administration?
Sure. And I will tell you right now, it's not frustrating to me at all. It's energizing. It's important. And if anything, I'm deeply encouraged by this particular scrape with this particular president at this level. It is elevating into the American consciousness in a way that hasn't been present for the last 10 or 15 years, a deep and important discussion about the value of journalism and the value of journalism in a free society and in our democracy, and the important role it plays in holding all people in power who represent the people or theoretically representing the people. And what is the relationship between what they say and what they do and how it serves the public? Journalists have always played that role in our country. And almost every American president in one way or another has clashed with the reporters covering that administration. It goes back to George Washington. John Adams famously created the Alien and Sedition Act, which was as much about suppressing the First Amendment as it was hardball politics. Many American presidents have clashed with the reporters in and around their administration. And in the modern era of American politics, almost every president in one way or another has privately or publicly disdained a free press. No one has taken it to the rhetorical level of this one. But any reporter who believes other presidents haven't taken a run at the institution of the press is wrong and historically oblivious.
He seems to
be... Donald Trump does do it at a level and at a velocity and at a volume that does not have precedent. But we should remember that the responsibilities and the protections of the First Amendment put a high premium and an incredible value on facts. And as was said in a different context a long time ago, facts are stubborn things. And I professionally, temperamentally, and spiritually rely on facts to carry myself through every day covering this White House.
He seems to be holding his own with his base, though, and convincing those people who support him that you folks are the opposition party and that you should keep your mouths shut and things like that.
Sure. And for his base, Donald Trump is not the one who introduced this concept. Many Trump supporters had already come to believe, for a lot of different reasons, that the so-called mainstream media was not a credible source of news. And look, I've told my colleagues, and I've given speeches about this. I gave a speech at the National Press Club last week. And I add this to almost any line I have about press, the First Amendment, and the Trump administration. I think whenever I'm introduced, it should be as follows. Major Garrett is a semi-well-known representative of an industry with declining market share and record low credibility. Okay, that's a fact. Both those things I just said are facts. Newspapering, which I grew up in, spent 17 years in newspapers before I moved into television. I've worked for news magazines, one of which doesn't even exist, U.S. News and World Report, as a print product any longer. It does as a digital online product. All that part of my industry has taken a hit financially, much smaller than it once was, much less respected than it once was, and has deep and abiding credibility issues, not just with Republicans, with independents, and with Democrats. The trajectory in Gallup polling on credibility of the media has been in a steady downward decline for 20 years. All of those things are relevant to the work we do and how we do it. But it doesn't mean that we're any less vital or any less relevant. We just have to prove ourselves. This brings me back to the reason I'm optimistic. I believe successful journalism does prove itself, and it proves itself best when the audience, singular and collective, is paying very close attention. And that's certainly the situation I feel we're in now.
It's interesting at this time, the most recent thing that I've heard about this is that both the New York Times and the Washington Post are experiencing surges in circulation and subscribership.
And subscribership, a great deal of that on their digital platforms, which is a very good thing because the new model for successful American journalism is not going to be based on hard copy circulation, how many newspapers you throw, which was the metric that I grew up in the newspaper business understanding, believing in, and understanding my future economic vitality as defined by. It's going to be on the digital platform. How many people come to your website, read through your stories, and then what you can pay or receive from those subscribers in terms of their payment and what you can collect in online advertising that keeps that enterprise going. But the interest in journalism is not at a peak, but it's higher than it was 6 months ago. And certainly a conversation about the role of journalism in a free society feels to me more vibrant than it did 3 or 4 years ago. It's a time of testing. We are being tested. We're being evaluated. And if we believe in all the things we say we believe in, we should welcome the scrutiny and carry it forward without emotion, without a sense of trying to win anything, just a sense of doing our job, staying in our lane, and producing good and believable journalism.
What kind of adjustments are journalists making, perhaps should be making, in coverage these days? I see this got some attention yesterday. Rachel Maddow of MSNBC is basically saying they're not covering the tweets anymore. They're just going to cover the actions of the White House. That's a little bit different than what's been going on. Are adjustments being made?
Sure. There is an adaptation process going on because if either individually or collectively news organizations come to the conclusion that tweets are a method of diversion or distraction for this or any other administration, then you value or devalue them as such. And if, in fact, the most important thing any White House does is the actions that intersect with the country and the people who live in it, that's always the most, by definition, newsworthy topic. And if you see tweets or come to see tweets as something that is meant to be, to use the cliche, the distracting, shiny object to take your attention and journalistic focus away from real things that are being done in the regulatory approach to the environment or to dual economy standards or to the defense budget or to the CIA or the Pentagon having control over drone strikes, all these other things, you have to ask yourself relentlessly, what's the most important topic? And I told my network, CBS, throughout the campaign, and I told it and I would tell it over and over again, and we have great conversations about this. Now that President Trump is in office, the great distinction that has to be made every single day is to report what's important, not merely what's interesting. And there are plenty of things around this presidency that are interesting, but there are also many things that are important and long-lasting. And I believe the adaptation process many news organizations are going through now is distilling the difference between the interesting and the important and trying to stay as close to the important as possible.
I mentioned Rachel Maddow. She broke a story last night that's received some considerable attention. The first couple of pages of Donald Trump's 2005 tax return. Much was made of it. What do you make of it, and how important is something like that?
Well, it's important on a couple of levels. First, it is a window into Donald Trump's finances circa 2005. We didn't have anything other than tax returns from an earlier era in his business life. My memory is 1999 was the one we knew most about, but I may be wrong on that. It's been a while since I've revisited the previous tax returns that appeared in the New York Times. But in the main, we know very little, and by we, I mean the public, knows very little about the structure and the contents and the year-by-year income and taxes paid by Donald Trump, the businessman. We know all the representations made by him and those who support him or work for him. He's a great businessman. He's made all this money. He's employed thousands of people, et cetera, et cetera. But we've never had a window into the actual dollars and cents of that in terms of taxes paid or revenue made. 2005 gives us a glimpse. It doesn't give us very much, but it gives us more than we had before. And to try to take a little bit of the wind out of the sails of that scoop, the White House confirmed what MSNBC through Rachel Maddow was going to broadcast last night by confirming the underlying details. It still does not give us any sense at all about the modern Trump financial system. And that's something that is still of great interest, according to public polling. It's of great interest to Democrats in Congress. It's even of some interest to some Republicans. And it may prove relevant in whatever investigation continues into any connections between Russian oligarchs, anyone working on behalf of Donald Trump, or his larger financial empire. He insists there's nothing there, never will be, never has been, but there's no tax data to reinforce or verify that. And this leaking of 2 pages of a 2005 tax return at least suggests that some of those other documents may actually be out there somewhere, and if they are, they may surface at some time in the future. But still, on this topic, so much less is known than previous candidates or previous presidents have shared with the public. That's also something very new that this particular president brings to this particular topic.
It's also been suggested that possibly these documents were leaked by the president himself.
So those of us who have been around Donald Trump for a while, I spent 16 months on the road covering his campaign, have a sense of how sometimes he sets things like this in motion. No proof about it whatsoever. It's harmful to speculate. I'm not going to speculate, but there are those who wonder, hey, as a diversionary tactic or as some sort of morsel to throw out there, he has, through an intermediary or someone who's sympathetic, this little morsel of a document, 2 pages, anonymously sent to a well-respected Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter with a long history in tax policy and tax coverage. He gets it, puts it on television, and then the very next day, the President of the United States denounces it as fake news, says it's entirely implausible for these documents to surface in the way they did, thereby getting a diversion on one hand, a big set of hysteria about a general news topic, and then the ability to deny it and denounce it the next day. If you are looking for lots of boxes that Donald Trump, as a candidate, Donald Trump as a private citizen, has liked to check off from a publicity and a long-term strategic point of view, this would fit that overall approach. But again, that's just taking an overall approach and overlaying it a set of facts. I have no evidence to back that up, not suggesting it happened, but those who are somewhat familiar with Trump's approach to these things can't rule it out, and the public will make a judgment for itself.
Just to change the subject somewhat, you spent 16 months on the campaign trail with Mr. Trump. Did the media miss the boat with regard to taking the pulse of America's heartland during that campaign, perhaps enchanted by the entertainment factor of this particular campaign as opposed to really determining what people were thinking, particularly in the middle of the country?
Well, I did a very long piece in the early part of September for CBS Sunday Morning. It was almost an eight-minute piece, very long on television, a network show of any kind. And it was really just the voices of the Trump supporters I had met along my travels throughout the country. And there's very little track, meaning very little narration from me, other than to say who these people were and where they were from, and in a general, very low-level way, describe what they felt and saw in the Trump campaign. So I was paying as close attention as I could to these very large crowds and this very enthusiastic following that Trump, the candidate, had. And I told all of my network executives 2 weeks before the election, don't be surprised. Don't everyone have a shocked look on their face on election night if Trump wins. So I'm not predicting a victory. None of the data indicate a victory. But these crowds are large, they're enthusiastic, and they're very politically entrepreneurial. And by that I mean they had their own T-shirts put together. They had their own signs put together. They took ownership of their own advocacy of Donald Trump in a way that I really hadn't seen in previous presidential campaigns. I think in general there was a tendency within the political press corps to rely on all the metrics and data and indicators that had been so reliable in the previous elections, and to give that greater weight because it had an almost a scientific authenticity to it, and not pay as close attention or give as much weight to the emotionalism that was clearly visible behind the Trump movement. It was, I think, in a general, simplified way, a clash between data, something that felt like science, and reliable indicators against emotion. And there was a tendency to weigh the former more than the latter.
Yeah, well, you were one of the few that picked up on that, I would have to say. One final question. I know you're on a tight schedule, but I'll end it with the subject area in which we started, and that is the question of trust in the media. What can people like you and the anchors and the folks upon whom so many people depend for their news every day, what can you do to reestablish whatever trust has been lost in this country?
It's a big question, and I don't think there is any one hard and fast answer. There are partisan perspectives on the news that are independent of what journalists can do to achieve or regain credibility. Because if you have a very hardened partisan point of view, left or right, things that you hear that you find ideologically disagreeable, you're going to dislike, even though they may in fact be credible and factual. I don't know how to deal with that particular issue at all. What I do believe is most important for journalists who do feel a bit fraught emotionally in this atmosphere of the accusations that come from the president, from the most powerful political operator in our country, is to not get emotional about that, not feel invested in that, not try to be at war with anyone or anything, not try to win anything or gain anything, but to simply focus on the rigorous demands of journalism and do it so well that it stands the test of time. You're only as good as your last story. That's the iron rule of journalism. And if you blow the last story, you've got to regain credibility in your newsroom. You've got to regain credibility with your audience. So make every story as good as it possibly can be, as believable as it can be, as wide-ranging and as curious as it can be, and as rigorously factual as it can be. And believe, as I do, that over the long run, that will stand the test of time.
Well, we'll let you get on to your next story there in Nashville, Major Garrett. Thank you so much for being with us.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you so much.
It's Major Garrett of CBS News. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU.